Evanston, Illinois. This is Bruce Dumont with our Beyond the Beltway analysis of national politics, featuring occasional injections of rumor and innuendo, all offered up by a panel of political insiders, pundits, power brokers, public servants, professors, and most importantly, plain-speaking Americans from coast to coast. Tonight, featuring commentary by Democrat Paul Vallis, Republican Chris Roebling, Democrat Roberto Montaño, Charles Lipson from the University of Chicago, and Republican Kenton McCarthy, as well as special guest Andrew Challenger, an outsourcing expert, and we'll be talking about turmoil in the American workplace and the changing face of the American economy. Thank you very much. Our program tonight coming from our new home base at the studios of WCGO Radio in Evanston, Illinois. That is in fashionable suburban Evanston, Illinois. That's just the first suburb north of Chicago, if you're not familiar with it. And again, it's great to have you with us. 1-800-723-8289 is the phone number. We are live on radio. We're also live on Facebook. And as was the case last week, right at this moment, we're opposite the President of the United States, who is having a coronavirus update. And so you are privy to what he's saying more than I am. So if you're listening to us with one ear and listening to the President or watching him with the other ear or eyes, as the program unfolds this evening, let us know what news is coming out of that press conference, because we would like to hear it from you. And again, we then can offer instant analysis from our listeners and viewers from coast to coast and around the world. And again, we'll begin this evening with a good Democrat and a good Republican. And they love America. They want to see the American success story continue. And we're going to talk about a variety of issues with them. I want to begin with Paul Vallis, who once upon a time was head of the Chicago public school system. Then he did things in the wake of Katrina in New Orleans, also worked in Philadelphia, as noted around the country, ran for mayor of the city of Chicago, and also lieutenant governor of the state of Illinois. Was unsuccessful, but he certainly ran for that office. So, Paul, let me begin with you, because I want to talk about the issue of education, because school has been out in many parts of the United States for several weeks now. What short-term and long-term impact is this going to have on education and test scores and a person's career?
I think it's going to have a great impact, particularly on low-income children. The poor schools do not have access to online learning, have few of the online learning resources that many of the more affluent school districts do. And obviously, children that are being raised in single parent households, sometimes operating from an economic development standpoint, from an economic standpoint on a marginalized existence, those young people are not going to have the supports in the homes that perhaps more affluent families can afford to provide for their children. So clearly there's going to be a disadvantage. And most of the schools in this country were really not equipped to provide the type of online education, remote learning opportunities.
Is this, and I want to bring in Chris Roebling, our Republican. Chris, is this another example of government, whether it's federal government, state government, or municipal government, with what we're trying to do in this patchwork response to this in the education community? Is this just another example of something, an American institution that was just not ready to be hit with this type of devastating action?
Yes, I think that's right. I think that we've known for, a good, 45 years that there was a possibility of a very serious flu pandemic. It's been warned about repeatedly. Many administrations have come and gone, have tried to raise the specter of just how debilitating such an outbreak would be to society. And many calls for preparedness, both from Democrats and Republicans, have gone unheeded. At the same time, I think folks are very pressed in education for a lot of different reasons. I think that's another whole conversation, but it's tough to ask local school boards to prepare for something that might never happen while they're in their term of office. So I think we have to face the very vexing question of how do you prepare when you don't know what might come. And that's exactly where schools have been, and it creates the inequitable situation to which Paul refers.
Paul, would you agree with that? And what is it that we can do now
right.
to play catch up so that when this thing comes back again, and if it does, it's, according to Dr. Fauci, it's likely to come back, we are better prepared?
Well, let me point out that I recently did a Wall Street Journal article about basically remote learning. And there's absolutely no reason why we can't mobilize to provide all schools with the capacity to provide remote learning. But it is not cost prohibitive. For example, even from a technology standpoint, if you took the approach of standardizing the technology, strategic sourcing and leasing the technology, you could literally equip every household and every child with the equipment needed. Now they're still acclimating yourself to remote learning, et cetera. But just from an equipment standpoint, it's not cost prohibitive. There just has not been a push to do that. And there's an opportunity here. Now, clearly we need to do things short term. We need to provide, schools need to provide parents with online educational options. They need to try to get the technology into the homes as quickly as possible. They need to get the internet providers to provide free Wi-Fi, et cetera. But the point that I want to make is the federal government is about to give $13 billion in Title I money to school districts. That's about an 80% increase. There is no reason on God's good earth that we can't prepare for the next pandemic, for the next earthquake, for the next hurricane. And, you know, I've been in all of those by building the type of remote learning infrastructure to not only address the issue of these type of long-term closures of schools, but more importantly, to have the type of technology infrastructure that can support regular instruction.
But we had a situation last week where in Chicago, which you know, there was an issue of there was a large number of computers that were going to be handed out to students and teachers. And in many of these homes, again, the low-income homes, they didn't have internet service. So again, do we start with just broadband capacity and making sure that you know, internet service is this a right for Americans to have now?
Absolutely, and this is where government can intervene. I mean, there's no reason on God's good earth that certain industries could not have been mobilized, and they've been mobilized so many times in the past. Have dealt with the issue of manufacturing masks or basically doing the ventilators. And I mean, South Korea. Had their first infection the same day we did, and look at what's happened in South Korea. I don't want to say they've eradicated the problem. That doesn't mean it won't reemerge, but they're experiencing a fraction of the problems that we have. So the point is, we can do that on the educational side. There is no reason why internet providers cannot provide every household with Wi-Fi. And in the rural areas, you know, we did this down in Haiti after the earthquake. You can equip vehicles like buses to be kind of like these localized, internet distribution centers. I'm using the technology. I'm not mm-hmm. referring to it the proper way, but there's no reason why you can't even reach out to schools and school districts in the remote areas to give them Wi-Fi, internet access.
But when we come back, we'll obviously talk about the basic need for the technology. But on one end of the technology, there is the teacher who's trying to use technology to teach something, whatever the subject may be. And in many cases at the moment, parents are trying to teach their kids at home. I want to talk about that when we come back. I'm Bruce Dumont. Thanks for joining us tonight.
This message is from the National Council on Aging. Adults over age 60 are at higher risk for the COVID-19 coronavirus because they may have weaker immune systems or chronic health conditions. The Centers for Disease Control recommends older adults avoid crowds and people who are sick. Wash your hands and disinfect surfaces often. Keep a 2-week supply of food and medicine on hand. Learn more at ncoa.org.
A few years ago, Steve Faircow's lungs were failing.
I don't think I had more than a couple weeks to live.
That's when Steve received a lung transplant made possible by an organ donor. Now Steve can do things he never imagined, like climbing 94 floors to the top of a skyscraper.
I never knew that breathing could feel this good. It's an incredible gift.
What could you make possible as an organ, eye, and tissue donor? Leave behind the gift of life. Go to organdonor.gov, U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, Health Resources and Services Administration.
Jason Lott back on Beyond the Beltway. Thanks very much for joining us tonight. 1-800-723-8289. We're talking with Paul Vallis and Chris Roebling, and we were talking about the problems in American education and how it is being devastated by what's happening right now. Yet some parents who are listening to this program, they may live in states where maybe the local school system does not have enough set up ready to go for using online teaching. And so many of them, as there are many people in this country who homeschool their children, are there some basic things that you could suggest to parents listening to the program, Paul, who, let's say they have a 9-year-old and a 12-year-old and a 13-year-old at home, they're going crazy because their school hasn't given them the lessons to learn. How do you begin teaching, you know, as a parent to a child during this period, which in many jurisdictions, they're not going back to school this year, or at least this semester?
Well, first of all, hopefully school districts have been communicating the online educational support programs that are already out there. I mean, you could literally Google them. They're all over the place. But hopefully one of the things that the schools have been doing is the schools have been kind of filtering programs that are quality programs, and they've been making recommendations. Many states, for example, have begun to invest in online education, creating their own virtual schools. I think the state defunded the Illinois virtual school this year. They're actually up there operating on their own. But most districts who are worth their salt should have, and I know most of them, at least many of them have been sending out information to parents, not only giving them materials that they can use to engage their children, but also giving them access to online educational support resources.
Chris, you have been a critic of public education for a long time. Is it possible that this can be a learning lesson where public education could get better? And I also want to expand the discussion by talking about higher education. Could it be that colleges are going to learn that you don't have to have large campuses with huge buildings anymore?
I'm the beneficiary of some of the finest public education in the United States. I went to New Trier. I got a lot from that experience. And my concern about public education ever since has not been about public education. It's been about the forces acting upon the institutions that are charged to deliver public education in the neighborhoods. And so that's an entire conversation. I think that your point, Bruce, and I think that Paul's intimate familiarity with the overcoming of obstacles to create platforms for distance and remote learning take note of rapid evolution in how people are learning today. And I know this is anathema in some quarters, but everybody from Prager University 5-minute videos to folks who are taking entire advanced degrees from accredited schools online, I've been fortunate in my work to visit the Middle East and a little bit in the Orient, and certainly in Europe and Latin America. And I would say that there's a ferment going on in the delivery of education. And yes, this event, which, for instance, my son, Charlie, came home from Granada, Spain, and he's now doing all of his classes with his Spanish professors over the internet from Roscoe Village. And it's new to them. The professors in Spain, it's new to the kids who were enjoying, as you can imagine, every moment that they were in Spain, yeah. Granada, Cordoba, et cetera. But these are the kinds of advances that are going on,
Paul, will,
the field.
I want to get Paul's response, because at the college level, and you've worked primarily in K through 12, but Paul, in your experience, do we have American teachers unions standing in the schoolhouse door saying we don't want long distance learning?
I think in the past there's been a lot of resistance, but I talked to a very prestigious university that will remain unnamed about the issue of remote learning. And even they've admitted that the faculty is a lot more amenable to now, you know, learning how to teach online and things like that. Look, next to local property taxes, student loans are probably the second biggest item that's destroying the middle class in this country. I saw a statistic the other day, not the other day, it was actually about a year ago, where they talked about for the first time in history, American middle class have percentage of the population is smaller, that we're no longer, you know, a big country with a predominant middle class. And they talked about two things, local taxes like property taxes and student loans. Mm-hmm. There's no students, graduate students, undergraduate students in four universities, community colleges, they can, you know, they don't have to go to these big monolithic university campuses. And or for that matter, these residential campuses, they can learn online. Grand Canyon, and I'm not suggesting, you know, I'm not drawing parallels, but Grand Canyon, a classic example, they have 17,000 students on campus in Arkansas or in Arizona, and they have 65,000 students online. Bradley University is now dramatically expanding their offerings online. Harvard, if you want to take courses and get a degree from Harvard, you can do it and live in California. So the technology is there to provide for remote learning, and just not remote learning where it's self-paced learning, where you're doing the courses yourself, but, and it's self-paced, but there's no reason why you can't have online virtual classrooms K-12.
Do you see, Chris, in addition to teachers unions, that was my question to Paul, do you see other entities, other power structures that are going to fight this in the future? Because, you know, they're a member of the alumni association from Harvard or Stanford. And frankly, they give a lot of money to the schools. The schools, you know, celebrate them in many ways. But is the power of the alumni association going to come down and squash some of these expansion efforts post, you know, coronavirus?
I don't think so. I think that there are forerunners and there are late adapters. And the forerunners would include things like Khan Academy, things like, you know, Paul is referring to Grand Canyon. He's referring to Bradley. You know, we've got Purdue University right across the state line in West Lafayette, Indiana. The president down there, former governor of Indiana, Mitch Daniels, done a mm-hmm. phenomenal job. He actually bought, I forget exactly which platform. I think he bought Kaplan. I'm not sure. Yeah. So there are folks out there who know. And I want to make this point. I have been involved in K-12 education in the Middle East. And I will tell you that if you want to solve the problems of the world, get into K-12 education in a big systemic way. You know, the teacher unions are, they are now essentially, in my humble opinion, I don't ask Paul to comment because he's got too many relationships, but you know, the teachers unions have saddled us with the problems that have led to the property taxes that folks, for instance, in Illinois are fleeing by going to Indiana, South Carolina, Tennessee, Texas, Florida, and other Wyoming low tax states.
Let me interrupt for a moment and ask Paul, because again, you do have a lot of relationships with unions and non-unions around the country. My question to you
some
is
good, some bad.
Has it become too easy to blame unions for the problems that we have in public education?
Well, as you know, as someone who created the nation's only 100% school choice district, which is New Orleans, where all the schools are in independent charter schools and they even have vouchers. I'm not going to blame the unions entirely for the. There's been resistance, but I've never found union leadership. Maybe it's because of the relationships that I've had with unions, so I've had to deal with on a one-on-one basis. But I've always found them to be receptive. There's no reason why K-12. I mean, the future is in remote learning. And you have to understand the opportunity that's here. If you want to close the achievement gap, if you want to provide poor children with access to the instructional resources and supports, you can do it via technology. If you build a system of remote learning where you can literally have remote instruction to deal with pandemics, then you have a system during normal times that can educate children who, for health reasons or disciplinary reasons, can't be in school. Or for that matter, you can use remote learning to increase the instructional day, to increase the instructional year. And there's nothing that closes the achievement gap faster than additional instructional time on task. So there's an opportunity here.
Go ahead,
Bruce. May I speak on that? Sure. I couldn't agree more with esteemed colleague Paul Vallis. And I'll tell you why. I had the privilege of my group was brought on board to help with curriculum and a lot of activities related to the first female-only STEM school in Saudi Arabia to be located in Mecca. Now, sadly, after MBS came in, there have been some bumps in the road, and we're not sure where that project is going to go. But we got very deep into the planning for this. And I think the future is a lot more like the Khan Academy and Prager University. You're going to have modules, and you're going to have, see, the schools have got two different axes. They've got sort of a competency axis, and then they've got a social emotional axis. And then you've got a third dimension to those two, which is age and age group. So the whole idea.
I want to give you an opportunity to follow up on that, Chris. We do have to break. 1-800-723-8029 from coast to coast and border to border and around the world at beyondthebeltway.com. I'm Bruce Dumont. Thanks for joining us tonight on Beyond the Beltway, back live from Evanston, Illinois, shortly.
Hi, this is Dr. Phil. The new coronavirus called COVID-19 is spreading in China and beyond. While CDC is working to stop the spread of the virus, we can all play a role in stopping this deadly disease. The CDC Foundation is a nonprofit organization supporting emergency response efforts in the United States and around the world. To get updates and learn how to protect friends and loved ones, find out how to help by going to cdcfoundation.org.
Chris Domine is a husband, father, an athlete, even an Ironman. But 10 years ago, Chris's kidneys were failing.
The doctor said, if you don't get a kidney transplant, you are going to die.
Chris received a second chance, made possible by an organ donor.
Your well-being changes from loss of hope to better times ahead.
What could you make possible as an organ, eye, and tissue donor? Leave behind the gift of life. Go to organdonor.gov. U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, Health Resources and Services Administration.
Bruce Dumont back in Evanston, Illinois. Thanks very much for joining us. We're talking with Paul Vallis, who once upon a time headed the Chicago public school system, also did a lot of work in Philadelphia, and also in the wake of Katrina, he headed up the education effort in New Orleans, and also Chris Roebling, a longtime commentator, conservative Republican commentator on this program. They join us this evening, and again, in just a few moments, we're going to be talking about some of the loss of jobs around the country, but again, we continue with Paul and Chris. The president in his press conference, by the way, that's still going on, is dealing with coronavirus. He's talking about all the things that are being done, the spreading of the ventilators around the country, what's in the supply chain, what's not in the supply chain, and responding to those that have been critical, including, I would say, right at the top of the list is Illinois Governor J.B. Pritzker. And again, he singled out Pritzker by name earlier in the last hour. And Chris Roebling, you're putting a thumbs up to that. But I want to ask both of you. I'm going to come back to you in just a moment.
Yeah, I want to make
Chris,
my point.
make the point, but then I want to hear from Paul as well, because you both have spent a lot of time dealing with politicians. So what's your reaction, Chris? And I want to get Paul's response as well.
Sure.
What on Trump, or can I finish my curriculum?
On Pritzker. Point? No, on Pritzker.
Oh, dang.
Well, you'll come back to that,
stupid.
But I want to.
First of all, I want to say I've been joined by Rufus. So Rufus is here.
Okay, good.
And says hello. And then number two, I want to say that these guys are crazy. I mean, why are they arguing with each other? I don't think anybody in the entire country is looking for their public officials to spat with each other when people are dying in the, you know, most abject, you know, most of these people are going to end up dying. They're going to asphyxiate.
Paul, why do you think Governor Pritzker is emerging as sort of the poster child for complaints around the country?
I think it's his ambition to be noted in the Democrat, in the National Democratic Party, and to get some kind of foothold at the federal level in what he anticipates.
I want to hear Paul Vallis's assessment of that same question.
Well, first of all, I agree with Chris. Let me point out that there's people, whether we like it or not, we have to adjust to Trump. He's a transactional figure. And when you attack him, he's going to try to punish you. And look at Newsom. There's in California, there's something like 71 lawsuits that the state has filed against the federal government because, Trump, whether it's automotive emissions and things like that. But yet he has kept the rhetoric down and he's focused on trying to get things through Trump by trying to avoid being confrontational or trying to get into his crosshair, so to speak. Cuomo is really trying to do the same thing. You know, it's really interesting. When Cuomo, listen to Cuomo, when the federal government delivers something to him, he always mentions Trump. When he wants to criticize the federal government, he mentions the administration. So, at some point, we've really got to focus on trying to find a way to get what we need without basically building up more barriers.
The governor has said, however, and he's not the only governor that said he thinks it is primarily the federal government's responsibility to have the necessary equipment in place. You both mentioned earlier in the program that it's very difficult for politicians, whenever, wherever, and whatever party they're with, to plan too much money and to spend too much money on planning for something that may or may not happen. So in this particular case, is the governor right, Chris? And is the president right? Is this a case where both politicians are right? We're seeing your nose now. Whatever you've just done, the American people are listening around the world have just gone up your nostril. We didn't see anything unusual up there, but go ahead.
My two cents. I think taxpayers everywhere want to hear people say, here's what we're doing today. Here's what we're doing tomorrow. The top priority is to save lives and to reduce the impact of this pandemic. And everything other than that, whether it's from Trump at the White House or Cuomo in Albany or Pritzker in Springfield, everything other than that, I think, is posturing and it's not helpful.
When is it right? I want to get Paul to respond to this. When is it appropriate, Paul? And is the media the most appropriate complainer on this case? Is when you have a situation in the last couple of weeks, there were masks that were sent to Alabama that had rot in them. They were totally wasted. There were things, allegedly ventilators, that were sent to California that were outdated. And they expired in 2015. Whose responsibility, it seems to me, that before you send something out, you should make sure that what you're sending out is not expired. If something expired in 2015 or 2010, which is the case with some of the ventilators, someone in another administration, the previous administration, did not do their job in making sure that expiration dates meant that what they had in their stockpile wasn't good. I mean, that's not Trump's fault, but it's somebody's fault. There's somebody who's got a name who was responsible for that, and it's somebody working now.
This is the problem. We're in the middle of a crisis, and we're trying to figure out whose fault it is.
Yes.
Here was my question, Paul. My question is,
what?
Does the media, is this a rightful question to be asked by the media? Because I agree with you. I don't want partisan finger pointing here. But what I'm just saying is, this is common sense. If I'm a taxpayer and I've just learned that $2 trillion are being used to get as much equipment out as possible, that what happens is that at some point people are saying, well, why are they sending old equipment? And that's because somebody somewhere, a government official somewhere, screwed up.
Look,
they don't want that to happen again.
Well, look, every single school district I've taken over has been a financial disaster. Yet I never once criticized my predecessor because my job wasn't to look back. My job was to look forward. Look, I don't think the media, I think to a certain extent, the media has to a degree been unfair when in every press conference, you ask him the same thing. Admit to responsibility. Admit you were late. Admit you didn't respond. Admit that you closed this office or closed that office. I'm not suggesting that any of these questions are not legitimate because they are. Because the things that Trump failed to do, he clearly failed to do. But what is that going to accomplish now except provoke a reaction?
So to answer your question,
how do you approach it? Somebody's got to be the adult in the room. And the problem is, all too often, there aren't any adults in the room.
Chris.
Yeah, Bruce, I want to say, you asked, when is it appropriate to ask that question?
Yeah.
That is what, as a former logistics planner for the United States Navy, I'm going to tell you that it's called the after action report. Why? Because today we got to get X ventilators to Y location. And sitting here today, as Paul points out, going from the windshield to the rearview mirror, say, oh, well, the ventilators aren't in the right warehouse, or they're going to the wrong warehouse, or they, whatever. Something happened 6 years ago. Nobody cares. People care. Are you doing something today that'll save lives tomorrow? That's it.
Chris, you articulated it so much better than me.
We have a caller, couple of callers. Let's go to Edward listening to us on WCGO in Chicago. Go ahead, Edward.
Yeah, and Chris, maybe in the next hour you can comment about the captain on Roosevelt. But my point on education is I think we need to educate more people on learning a trade. You know how you have this distillery making hand sanitizers?
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Or maybe somebody in the fabric industry making face masks.
Yeah.
I think that's something that we need to steer our young people to learn a trade so that way they can be multi-talented.
Paul, yeah, there's response.
There's no doubt. I'm going to respond really quick. You know, Crystal Ray is a great model. Crystal Ray High School, the kids not only are going to high school, four-year high school, so that they can graduate and be eligible to go to college, but they're in work study all 4 years. So they're going to high school, obviously meeting their academic requirements while they're in a work study program, school to work program. There's no reason why you can't do that. I mean, there is so much wasted time in schools right now with irrelevant coursework, with irrelevant electives, where you could easily incorporate work study, in some cases paid work study, and you could get these kids working and not only in a trade, but just out there in the work world working, being exposed to the work world and all the things, the responsibilities that go with it. So at the end of the day, the caller is absolutely right. There's no reason why we can't migrate to an education that provides those type of experiences.
Okay. Bonnie, in Crown Point, Indiana. Go ahead. Hello, Bonnie. Are you there?
Yeah. Can you hear me?
Yeah, go ahead.
I'm hearing
You know what, Bonnie? We got a very bad line. We're going to cut you off, not because of anything that you want to say, but again, we need a quality line, so you may want to give us a call,
Bruce,
back. By the way, go ahead.
In light of the last question, may I please finish my curricular point?
You've got 15 seconds to do it.
Oh, geez. Well, I think that folks should be encouraged to learn at their pace and with encouragement from teachers. And I think we're going to see a blossoming of methodologies for teachers to assist kids in the K-12 age bracket, so that the ones who want to go to an IB and get an international baccalaureate and get three languages, they're going to do that. The ones who are going to be great in science and math and go to IIT, that's great. And then the kids who want to become Mercedes repair people and make $180,000 a year 3 years after high school, they're going to be able to do it.
Gentlemen, we have to pause. When we come back, we're going to talk about the job market. How difficult is it?
Every year, millions of Americans use opioids to manage pain. Pain can be unrelenting, overwhelming, and all-consuming. So why do so many of us try to manage pain only from the palm of our hands? Doctor-prescribed opioids are appropriate in some cases, but they just mask the pain. And reliance on opioids has led to the worst drug crisis in American history.
That's why the CDC recommends safer alternatives, like physical therapy, to manage pain. Physical therapists treat pain through movement, hands-on care, and patient education. No warning labels required. And by increasing physical activity, you can also reduce your risk of other chronic diseases. Pain is personal, but treating pain takes teamwork. When it comes to your health, you have a choice. Choose more movement and better health. Choose physical therapy. Visit moveforwardpt.com to find a physical therapist in your area. This message is brought to you by the American Physical Therapy Association.
Bruce Dumont back on Beyond the Beltway. We will get back to Paul Vallis and Chris Roebling in just a moment. But I want to spend some time here talking with our special guest. He's Andrew Challenger. He's with Challenger Gray and Christmas. That is an outsourcing firm. And I want to talk a little bit about the turmoil in the workplace and the way in which the American economy is going to be affected by what's literally happening in the country right now. Andrew, I want to begin because you're getting input from all over the country about what's happening in the workplace. Is there a bigger problem in the workplace with white collar workers or with blue collar workers, in your opinion?
Yeah, it's a good question. The brunt of the pain that's happened over the last 2.5-3 weeks in the labor force has been really concentrated on lower wage workers, small businesses, particularly restaurants, bars, barbershops, the types of jobs that cannot be done remotely and require foot traffic from customers have been affected most dramatically, and the numbers are really big.
Okay. Now, one of the things is that for those people who accept a loan from the government, which can turn into a grant, as I understand it, and there's a lot of money in the package for this, that if they keep their employees on payroll, I think it's what through the end of June, if they keep their people on payroll, it becomes a grant. They don't have to pay that loan back. Is that a correct analysis or assessment of at least one of the government programs?
That's a correct assessment of one of the programs. And I think it's a really important tool that the government is deploying during this crisis to keep people, keep Americans marginally attached to a job with benefits, with security, with a place to go back to once this crisis passes. And hopefully it will allow us to climb out of this hole, this deep hole, more quickly than, say, the 2008 financial disaster.
And that's the payroll protection part of the government activity here, right? Called payroll protection?
Yeah, that is the element of that $2 trillion package that's aimed at small and medium-sized businesses to allow them to keep employees on their payrolls as opposed to furloughing or permanently laying them off.
Does someone have to let the government know from the get-go whether their plan is to keep these people on? I assume most of the businesses are going to say they want to keep these people on because they would like this bailout to be a gift from the government.
Yeah, well, it's a complicated thing, right? Employers may get these loans with the absolute belief that they can keep employees on for a period of time. There's a lot of unknowns about how long this will persist. Employers that can't bring in new business for 3-4 months are going to have a much more difficult time carrying employees through that time.
Now, if I'm a small business person and coronavirus has hit and the American economy is hit, and obviously my goal is to survive, but yet let's say that I've had a marginal business. Let's say that I've been thinking about making some changes. Let's say that part of the changes that I want to make are some employees who either aren't doing a good job or I've been thinking about how I can move them around or retrain them. I mean, does it force an employer to keep people around who ordinarily they may not want to keep around?
It's a possibility. I think in this moment, employers that are taking on these loans with the hope that they won't have to pay all or portions of it back are a reasonable thing to ask them to keep employees on through the period. It's really the main goal of these funds. We want businesses to survive, but as opposed to just giving cash directly to employees, these are loans meant to keep businesses open and also keep people on the payroll.
Now, for those people who have lost their job or they work in non-essential jobs, these are the people that are eligible for unemployment insurance. Is that correct?
Yeah, so there's a lot of those folks were already eligible for unemployment insurance, but the pool of people that are eligible due to this new CARES Act has been expanded. So people that work part-time, gig workers, independent contractors, people that are self-employed are now eligible at certain levels for unemployment who have never been eligible for unemployment before in the history of the program.
Do you think, and again, in this case, there's an additional $600 above and beyond what they would normally get? Is that the figure where that comes in?
I believe it's $600 for some folks at the base level. It can go up if you have a partner, if you have dependents. There's incremental scales.
Okay, all right. My question, a quick answer on this one. At some point, do you think there's a lot of people out there wondering whether it's better to take unemployment or stick with the job for another 6 months?
For some people, there is the possibility that they may be earning a little bit more to go on unemployment for right. A short period of time.
Andrew, I want to follow up on that when we come back. We're talking with Andrew Challenger. He'll be back on the other side of news along with Chris Roebling and Paul Vallis. I'm Bruce Dumont. Thanks for joining us tonight on Beyond the Beltway.
What is hope? Hope to me was just that he would get to come home. I had no idea how hard it would be once he got back.
I wish she'd stop drinking so much. She thinks it's helping, but it's not. I hope she sees that soon.
I act like I don't care if he comes to my games. But I hope he does.
I used to hope he'd find happiness again. Now I hope our marriage makes it.
I hope Grandpa will get help. He thinks it's too late, but it's not.
With everything that he's going through, I hope he sees a counselor. I just want my brother back.
I hoped he'd get help. Stop hoping things would get better on their own. He told me to stop asking. I didn't. Then one day he asked for a ride.
Hope is knowing there are other families just like yours, that the veterans they love got help and recovered. Go to maketheconnection.net and turn hope into action.
Matt always knew he wanted to be a doctor. That's why he makes the most of every day. To study before breakfast. To work hard. To do whatever was necessary to achieve his goal. He found an answer in the military. If you have a passion, a vision for your future in any field, todaysmilitary.com can be your path to a fulfilling career. You have a calling. We have an answer. Find your way at todaysmilitary.com.
My name is Bobby. I'm a veteran and lost my leg to a roadside bomb. My victory was going from a wheelchair to becoming a weightlifting champion.
I'm Sam. I'm a veteran. My victory was finding a career I can be proud of
and supporting my family.
America's veterans are on their most important tour, the tour of their lives.
I'm a veteran. My victory was going from homeless to home.
At DAV, we're on a mission to help veterans get the benefits they've earned.
I'm a veteran, and my victory was finishing my education.
DAV offers veterans of all generations a lifetime of support for victories great and small.
My victory was proving that disability is not a limitation.
My victory was getting my service dog and new best friend.
We help more than a million veterans every year as they face and conquer their challenges.
My victory is being able to be there for my family.
When America's veterans win, we all win. Help us support more victories for veterans. Go to DAV.org.
Standing up for what's right. Helping out when things go wrong. Seeking the truth and speaking our minds. Not just making records, but breaking them. Leading the way behind the camera, beyond the runway, and on the silver screen. Not just making our mark, but making a difference. Now that's a job for a Girl Scout. Girl Scouts, preparing girls for a lifetime of leadership.
Bruce Dumont back with hour number two of Beyond the Beltway. This afternoon, I was going through the internet, and I ran across a great video, and it was produced by the Surgeon General of the United States. And in the wake of all this discussion about wearing a mask, not the medical kind, but suggesting that, you know, you get some cloth and you cover your mouth when you go out of your house, if you have to go out of your house. And it's a very succinct video, runs just a little over a minute. And this is what my mask looks like now. And you can see that it's somewhat fashion forward because it matches my hat. But let me just show you how simple it was. It starts with a piece of cloth, a square piece of cloth like this. This actually is a napkin. So if you wanted to have one for each day of the week or one that matches your hat or your outfit, you could do it. But all you really need, it's a folding concept. And it's this and some rubber bands, some long rubber bands. And again, if you go to the website and you look up the Surgeon General of the United States, he will tell you how to make these masks. It took me about 45 seconds to make it. I'm going to make a couple more. I wanted to be in red today because our background here at the station is red. So again, this is what you could do. Go through some napkins. You'll probably have some napkins, but you could do it with an old, t-shirt or, you know, whatever your favorite team is, and you can make a very unique mask. So anyway, just a little advice, something you can do. We're talking about the future of jobs in America, and Andrew Christian, who's a job expert, and Paul Vallis from our previous segment also joins us, the former head of the Chicago Public School System and a national education expert. And I want to go back to you, Andrew, and just to clarify, because I asked before the break whether you think that there will be some people out there trying to game the system and decide whether or not it's better to get unemployment or stay on the job with their employer. What would your advice be? Is this something nobody should try to game this system at this moment?
Yeah, certainly don't think people should try to game the system. Inevitably there may be a handful of people do, but look, this is a very deep crisis, and the way to address it right now is to not be very picky with how we're sending people money. They're going with a tactic of carpet bombing the country with an infusion of cash at a time when it's unbelievably necessary. And it seems to be the right approach to get us through at least the next month.
And also, we should mention that if you are expecting a refund from the government and you are in their system for direct deposits, you are going to get your money first, and it's going to be on an ascending order. In other words, if you're a taxpayer who doesn't pay much in taxes, you're going to be in the first wave of checks that go out. And if you're a high earner, you'll still, you know, as long as you're under $99,000, you're going to get your check, but it's going to be further. It's going to be a few weeks away, not necessarily in the next couple of weeks. And also, we should mention that if you're not into the federal system or you're not into the automatic deposit, direct deposit, You could wait, according to published reports, you could wait several months because they have to send you, they've got to cut a specific check and send it out to you. So that's something else you and your tax people should be figuring out and not inundate the government phone lines and email by asking some pretty basic questions that can easily be found out there. Paul Vallis, I want to go back to you for just a moment and bring you into our conversation with Andrew, because, again, you know, we talked about what teachers are doing. Is this a growth time to be a teacher? Or because of all the things that you talked about in hour number one, is this sort of a scary time to be a teacher? Because there may be dramatic changes coming forward that maybe a teacher is not interested in learning a new way to do their job.
Well, clearly, I think what you're going to see post-pandemic, because this won't be the last pandemic we have, and I think the country will always be prepared to react aggressively based on the past experience. And there's going to be a political price to pay for this. You know, how it evens out, there's going to be political consequences. But at the end of the day, I think it's a growth period. And I think what you're going to see is you're going to see a lot of states expanding their teacher certification requirements to ensure that the teachers have the ability to deliver curriculum instruction online. Look, it's the wave of the future. I mentioned that with the federal government about to invest $13 billion in education, which in effect raises Title I spending for school districts 80%. And most districts have stable revenues because they're getting property tax, stable property tax revenues. And the state can't reduce their funding or they don't get the federal funding in return. There's going to be an opportunity here to build the type of remote learning infrastructure that will not only allow you to deal with these emergencies. And God knows I've been through a lot of them, but it will also give schools the capacity to offer extended day instruction, extended year instruction. It'll give teachers the capacity to get into the homes, to connect more effectively with parents. So I believe that that states are going to move to require that teachers who do become certified, conditional for certification, will require a certain mastery of that test.
Andrew, as you look at the people who are out of work now, what career advice would you give to them? Obviously, they're worried right now about getting the unemployment check that's going to keep them going for hopefully a couple of months, but maybe not. I mean, there may be another stimulus package that's down the road. At least the president has hinted at that. But what advice would you be giving to those people that are out of work? And maybe they're between 35 and 50 years old.
Yeah, you know,
I want to get Andrew's response to this.
Yeah,
and then we'll come back to you. Go ahead, Andrew. Sorry.
Yeah, in some ways, the most important work that job seekers do hasn't changed, and that's networking with people that can help you navigate your way into new positions. The way you do that has changed dramatically. You're not going to conferences. You're not handing out business cards or taking people to coffee. But there's a lot of people at home right now that have extra time on their hands that may be feeling more generous with their time. And if you're an unemployed person, it's a great time to reach out to former coworkers, people you know at companies that you'd like to work for, and ask for a little bit of their time to talk about their organization, mm-hmm. what it's like to work there, and how at the end of this crisis they may be able to apply for positions. It's a great time to do that type of networking.
Or also to follow Paul Vallis' suggestion that maybe teaching is in your future. Paul, I didn't mean to cut you off, but go ahead.
No, that's quite all right. In fact, I'm glad Andy picked it up. Look, I mean, you're going to have to develop the capacity to work online. It's going to impact so many industries. And so people need to brush off those credentials. Look, you know, I do most of my work now online from a distance. So I've seen very little interruption in the type of work that I'm doing. In fact, I'm probably saving 2 hours a day in not only commuting time, but also just in transportation costs and in parking and things like that. So clearly the economy is going to be changed permanently. And I think obviously the capacity to you're going to see the emergence of more occupations, more
Paul, job opportunities. We've got to go. Paul Vallis, thank you very much for joining us. And also Andrew Challenger from Challenger, Gray, and Christmas. I'm Bruce Dumont. We will continue with new guests in a moment.
This message is from the National Council on Aging. Adults over age 60 are at higher risk for the COVID-19 coronavirus because they may have weaker immune systems or chronic health conditions. The Centers for Disease Control recommends older adults avoid crowds and people who are sick. Wash your hands and disinfect surfaces often. Keep a 2-week supply of food and medicine on hand. Learn more at ncoa.org.
A few years ago, Steve Faircow's lungs were failing.
I don't think I had more than a couple weeks to live.
That's when Steve received a lung transplant made possible by an organ donor. Now Steve can do things he never imagined, like climbing 94 floors to the top of a skyscraper.
I never knew that breathing could feel this good. It's an incredible gift.
What could you make possible as an organ, eye, and tissue donor? Leave behind the gift of life. Go to organdonor.gov, U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, Health Resources and Services Administration.
Bruce Dumont back in Chicago or in Evanston. Nice to have you with us this evening. 1-800-723-8289 is the phone number. And we are now joined by three new guests who are going to join us. First of all, Roberto Montaño, who is a Democrat. He joins us from Chicago. Charles Lipson from the University of Chicago also joins us. And a Republican joining us is Kenton McCarthy, and he joins us from Arizona, although he looks like he's popped off the line here for a moment, but hopefully he'll be back. Roberto Montaño, let me bring you into the conversation, because you're a commercial real estate guy.
That's right, yeah.
Can you think of a worse profession to be in right now?
Oh, I am honored to be in commercial real estate. There's so many people right now that need our help that my phone has not stopped ringing.
Let me just stop you for a moment. If people are going, if businesses are going out of business, why is it they're learning to learn run their businesses maybe with fewer people? Why is your business so great?
Businesses are transforming how they business. There is a great, great carnitas restaurant in Wilson on 18th Street, and they had a line socially distanced down the street. And business continues. So now what they've done is they become more social media savvy. They're hiring marketing people and they're investing to grow market share. Right now, people are picking up the phone and building mind share so they can get market share. You know, this came to pass. It didn't come to stay. And those folks that had the reserves are going to be in business in 60, 90, 120 days.
Charles Lipson from the University of Chicago. Charles, when you talk about society and how it's changing or how your life is changing, is the idea of going out to dinner with friends on a Saturday night at a nice restaurant, is that a social experience that might not return in any large degree?
I think it will return. I sure hope it does. I mean, it's a wonderful way that we get together. Now, I also think that we'll be using a lot more media like we're doing right now. And we'll find that some of the uses don't work out very well. I really enjoyed the conversation in the last hour, Bruce, about education. And I think that it's going to be harder probably in the younger grades to do a lot of that. And in the older grades, you'll have a lot more content. And I hope that some of the content that's being done now will be recorded so the rest of us can take advantage of it later. So I think there's going to be a lot of transformations, and I think it's going to be really hard to predict what it is. I was really struck by what Roberto just said. It completely surprised me that his phone would be ringing because people need commercial space.
Yeah, that surprises me. Kenton McCarthy, you join us from Arizona. Nice to see you again this evening. You were a guest with a phone caller last week, and we'll get to your point in just a moment. But generally speaking, when you look at the things that have changed, what are the changes in society that you think are going to become a way of life if and when this pandemic is over in the not too distant future?
Gosh, if I only knew. Here's my biggest concern. I manage money for cities, so I'm essentially a risk manager. But the way society today is constructed is just a variety of complex systems that kind of interact, overlap, but feed on each other. What we've done is we've asked a certain section of complex systems to be shut down and yet have no impact on the other. My biggest concern is an economic collapse is typically followed by a sociological collapse. And when that social contract frays, then things start to unspool quickly, dramatically, and they're really hard to tether in.
How does it break? Tell me what you mean by breaking down the social contact. Compact.
Social contract? Yeah. Well, that's what keeps us acting as normal citizens. We can be collectivists to a certain point. We can say we're doing the right thing. We're doing this is for the good of society. And at some point, we're going to say, you know what? I got to make changes for myself. When you have vast swaths of unemployed, lower class, unskilled people put out of work, telling them it's illegal to go to their job, at some point, they have to feed themselves. They have to feed their kids. So for them to act as collectivists and say, oh, I'm doing it for the better good, or I'm just going to work for home, that's a stretch.
Do we see, and I want to start with you, Charles, do we see or do you fear a separation between the blue collar workers that Kenton was just talking about and the white collar community?
What he's raising is a very interesting point. I do think that there could be a separation. I think a lot of this depends on how long it lasts. The first relief bills are designed to go for what, a couple of months or something like right. that. I think if you have to go much beyond that, it's not just a question of financing. It's just a question of it's very hard to keep people in their houses for that long and so forth. I think what's likely to happen is that there will also be a separation by age so that younger people will begin to go out and be allowed to go out and it's proper for them to go out and older people who are more vulnerable or will be asked to stay home.
Roberto, we live in a city that is, we're supposed to all be staying home, okay? And most of us are staying home unless they go out once a week to do a radio show or they go to a drive-in restaurant to get dinner once in a while. Are you surprised at the ease with which this monumental government dictate, at least in Chicago and the state of Illinois and many other states around the country, how relatively easy it has evolved with few, at least outbreaks of insurrection?
You know, Bruce, in Chicago, we've had a couple of tragedies. We had our first police officer pass away.
Right.
And I think that's pretty sobering. You know, here are our protectors. Now, he was a narcotics officer undercover, not a lot of contact with the public, but one of our Chicago's, you know, finest. And those things just sober you up and you do your part. And I think that fundamentally, Democrat, Republican, whatever, we're all patriots. I think we all love our country.
No, but Roberto, that's great. And I would hope that everybody would do it. But if we drove through the Pilsen neighborhood or Little Village, which are Hispanic neighborhoods in Chicago, would we see many people on the street? Would they be sitting on their porches? Would they be in their houses? And again, as the weather gets better and this thing is no longer, something that was just dictated by the mayor, is this something that are people going to start rebelling against this? And I don't care whether they're in Chicago. They could be listening in Los Angeles or, 40 other states around the country.
You know, a lot of us went to church today virtually for the first time. St. Procopius, where I was baptized on 18th Street, I got to see my friend online. It's kind of a strange thing, but these are the sacrifices. We're in Lent. And talk about Little Village, talk about Pilsen. A lot of us happen to be Catholic. And Catholicism, in my opinion, is about love and serving one another. we have to do what we have to do for the greater good. Now, in Pilsen, specifically where I live across from Harrison Park. On Wednesday, for the first time ever, I saw police officers in the park. Now, nobody is congregating. I mean, the lake is different. Mm-hmm. In the neighborhoods, nobody's congregating. But people do go for a walk. They go for a run. You're allowed to go out for a breath air, fresh air. But my personal feeling is that businesses that are in the restaurants, for example, mm-hmm. they're going to have a tough time right now. Mm-hmm. But a lot of folks are adjusting.
I want to go back to Kenton. Kenton, it's been suggested by Dr. Fauci that this virus may come back again. It may come back in the fall.
It's about time. Let me tell you one.
Or it may come back next year.
Exactly.
What happens if it comes back
again? Wait,
again?
Do you know how long the Justinian virus lasted that took out the Byzantine Empire?
No.
225 years.
Okay.
Now, they didn't have scientists like we do, and they didn't have central bankers running scared like we do today. So this idea, my biggest fear is we're going to go in lockdown and we're going to put millions out of business forever. We're going to fundamentally alter the business landscape and the social landscape. And all of a sudden in June or July or August, we're going to say, oh, we got to do it again. You can't do this again. This is national suicide. I mean, I tweeted to you this afternoon. I think short term, Anthony Fauci is the biggest threat to what remains of our society, our economy, and our democracy.
Elaborate.
If he's given the privilege or the honor or the dictate to say how long and to what degree he's going to shut down our economy, that's going to ruin everything. The economy is the sinews that keep everything bound together, and they're fed with money going to and fro. So you're interrupting that. You're going to have these complex systems start to break down. You can't put those back together in August.
Okay. That's a very combustible statement. I wouldn't expect anything less from you. But again, it also makes us all think. And when we come back, I'm going to start with you, Charles, when we come back. I want you to sort of follow up on Kenton's comments. And that is the power at the moment, the power of the microphone by Dr. Anthony Fauci. He has the ear of the president, at least as of the moment. And I want to get your reaction and everybody else's reaction. 1-800-723-8289. I'm Bruce Dumont.
Hi, this is Dr. Phil. The new coronavirus called COVID-19 is spreading in China and beyond. While CDC is working to stop the spread of the virus, we can all play a role in stopping this deadly disease. The CDC Foundation is a nonprofit organization supporting emergency response efforts in the United States and around the world. To get updates and learn how to protect friends and loved ones, find out how to help by going to cdcfoundation.org.
Chris Domine is a husband, father, an athlete, even an Ironman. But 10 years ago, Chris's kidneys were failing.
The doctor said, if you don't get a kidney transplant, you are going to die.
Chris received a second chance, made possible by an organ donor.
Your well-being changes from loss of hope to better times ahead.
What could you make possible as an organ, eye, and tissue donor? Leave behind the gift of life. Go to organdonor.gov, U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, Health Resources and Services Administration.
Christian Watt back in Evanston, Illinois. Thank you very much for joining us tonight. 1-800-723-8289. For those of you who are either obviously listening on radio stations around the country or watching us on our Facebook Live post, we're not live on YouTube at the moment. That because of our new configuration, that is on a delay basis. But again, you can see this show on YouTube later on the night. But again, if you're listening on Facebook Live, you are watching us at Beyond the Beltway with Bruce Dumont. That's our Facebook Live page. But again, if you are a regular listener or if you are a regular participant on this program, you have been a guest on this program, I encourage you to go to Beyond the Beltway Fans. Look up Beyond the Beltway Fans It is a separate Facebook page, and you can join us. I mean, ask to join, and I will accept everybody, because that is about continuing a relationship with people that you've heard and seen on this program. And not only will you continue to see and hear them on this program, but also periodically they're very active on Facebook. They write very great essays. Kenton McCarthy is one. Charles Lipsum is prodigious in what he has to write. And this is another opportunity to stay in touch with the people that you hear and see on this program. And they publish their stuff at the Beyond the Beltway fan page. So if you've not done that, I would expect hopefully lots of people are going to do that after the broadcast this evening. And again, whether it's radio or television, this is an opportunity for us. And again, in this time when we have to find new ways to communicate, I'd also be very interested in knowing how you're reacting to sort of the evolution of this program. And, you know, for 39 and a half years, we had four people sitting around a table and having a wonderful conversation. And again, we lost the ability to do that when the Museum of Broadcast Communication was shut down over a COVID virus. So now we're doing it from a radio station, but there's nobody else here, no other guests with me here at the radio station, but they're guests that you know. We have them from around the country as well as from around Chicago. And again, Kenton McCarthy is from Arizona, joins us tonight. And we had guests last week who joined us from California. So again, we're changing. I'd love to get your assessment as to whether you think this new format is working or not. I can't say there's not too much I can do to change it, but again, it would be good to hear whether the new format is actually fewer guests and we change them more often. I'd like to know how you are reacting to that. Let's go back to Charles Lipsum. I asked a question before the break, and that is, what if this becomes a cycle for us in America? Kenton basically said he doesn't think there's a way we can survive that, with the dictates that are coming out of Andy Fauci and the ability of the president at least to agree with him on many scientific points. Your reaction, Charles?
Between two kinds of bounce back. One would be if we, let's say, started letting people out next week and then had a second wave that came through. And that's essentially what seems to be happening in China. Another would be if we let people out in a prudent way, but it comes back in a seasonal way like the flu. And I think that the good news there is that there are a number of treatments that look very promising. And then beyond that, there are some vaccines, and not just one vaccine. There are a whole number of candidate vaccines that are going to be tested. But I just saw today yet another treatment that's already on the market. This one for parasites has been found in Australia to be very effective in the test tube. Since it's already out there, they can almost immediately begin testing it for safety and effectiveness on humans. I would say one more thing about the bureaucracies and Anthony Fauci and so forth. It's a common feature in all these bureaucracies that they are focused on one thing. So the health bureaucracy is focused on health, and the economic bureaucracies are focused on that. And what I've been impressed by actually in the Trump administration is pushing the health bureaucracies to move quickly, because they don't normally want to do that. They want to button it down and have everything nailed down, and it requires that. But the big decision that is coming is the economic reopening and how they're going to do that.
I want to follow up on that, but I want to go to Roberto to get his response to what you've just said and also what Kenton said. And that is, do you agree that the health bureaucracy, which everyone is hailing right now, these are the New York City firefighters and police officers, and everybody wants to hail them because of the tremendous job that they are doing. But again, at some point, if the patient lives but the hospital closes, I mean, are you worried about that, Roberto?
I have good news for everybody, which is that there is a study that came out on the 26th of March, just about last Thursday at MIT, and it studied specifically this question. And what they deduced, these are MIT people, neither, you know, they're academics, I guess, but they're neither economists. Well, they are economists, but they're looking at both sides, balancing both. What it said is that stronger pandemic responses yield better economic recoveries based off of the 1918 flu pandemic data that they had. And so here's the quote, "We find no evidence that cities that acted more aggressively in public health terms performed worse in economic terms." This is assistant professor at MIT Sloan School of Management. So it's not like the public health school. This is a business school.
Now, in this particular case, one of the things is that obviously what has emerged here is you've had the federal government as represented by the president. You've had governors that have popped up. Some more critical of the federal administration than others. Certainly our governor here in Illinois has been the poster child for that in recent weeks. But my question is, so we're dealing between those that believe in states' rights or what's happening at the state level and the news media, which has an opportunity to take a side here. They're taking the side of the governors because they will give the federal government and Trump will get no credence at all, whether it's Trump suggesting that hydrochloroquine, you know, might work. I mean, they banged him on that. They're not going to give him an inch in their coverage of this story. So my question to you is, and I'm going to ask Kenton, we do have 9 governors at this moment, unless they've changed before we went on the air. We have 9 governors that have not shut down their states. They're all Republicans. Most of them are grouped, you know, I mean, North Dakota, South Dakota, and Iowa and those. I'm going to come back to you, but I want to get Kenton's response here. Is the next several months or several even weeks, because again, what lies ahead, according to the federal government and Dr. Fauci, is, I mean, all hell is going to break loose in the next couple of weeks.
Well, are
we setting up a situation where we're going to look at the results of who dies in those 9 states and say, you know what, those governors were right?
If you ignore my tweets like almost everyone else does, including myself, you'll notice that I said a pandemic is much too serious a matter to be entrusted to doctors because they look through a universal lens, a morally noble lens, but they don't see the collateral damage or the externalities. Also, the first casualty in a pandemic is context. So we're trying to force feed a universal decision or strategy with no previous history, no owner's manual, and think it's going to work out. And yet we do. Federalism does allow governors to make certain calls in their own state. We've had a food fight here in Arizona the last 2 weeks like you would not believe.
And you like that. I mean, you're a federalist.
I have no problem with Doug Ducey laying out his side, and then I have no problem with Senator Sinema bleeding 20 hours a day on Twitter that he's doing it wrong and she's saving lives, therefore he isn't. We've got a binary argument. Is you either follow along with this draconian response because we're saving lives or you're killing people. Those are the only two options allowed today. I don't buy that.
Okay, but Charles, back to you. When we look at 3 months from now, if we're all here and we come back again, 3 months from now, are we going to be saying to these 9 governors, are we going to be saying, you guys called it right, you didn't shut your states down, you may have had some deaths, but they were not catastrophic level like New York, and that you guys, you gutted it out and your decision was the right decision for your state. May not be the right decision for the rest of the country, but it was the right state for your state. It was the right decision for your state. Are we going to be there?
I think that Trump has done the right thing in not trying to federalize everything and do a one size fits all. I mean, I'm old enough to remember when the 55 mile an hour speed limit was imposed across the country. And people out in Montana and Wyoming just thought it was ludicrous because it was. Now, the governors that haven't shut their states down, they'll have to bear responsibility for that. Right. But I'll wager this. if there's a hot spot that breaks out in Pierre, in the Dakotas or Bismarck or something, they'll immediately act. I don't doubt that they'll do that. But I think that the media point that you made is absolutely right. I mean, Trump will either make an error as far as the mainstream media goes by opening up too soon or opening up too late. He'll not be able to get it right as far as they're concerned. What? I think that that's just sort of baked into the cake, and we just need to move on from it.
When we come back, we're going to hear from Roberto Montagna with the rest of our panel, and we'll also hear from phone calls. We got a lot of them on the line. We'll bring them into the conversation when we come back. I'm Bruce Dumont. Thanks for joining us tonight on Beyond the Beltway. We'll bring them into the conversation when we come back. I'm Bruce Dumont. Thanks for joining us tonight on Beyond the Beltway. Back on Beyond the Beltway. Thank you very much for joining us tonight. Let's go to Matthew, who's listening to us in San Jose, California. Go ahead, Matthew.
Bruce, I want to mention in California, the social distancing, they seem to be working. Okay. I'm staying at home. But one thing I do want to applaud is Gavin Newsom, showing leadership, showing what we need to do, having directives. There's that one voice. Here's one issue I want to bring up. We all remember Katrina. We all remember Russell Honoré. You know, we saw that film, you know, he comes into a square in the streets, his weapons down, takes the entire situation under control. Mm-hmm. We need one voice. And I agree with Kevin. You know, there is an economic impact. We all know that. It's horrible. But there has to be one voice. The challenge, we have too many voices, and everyone's got an opinion, and there is no playbook for this.
For those listening around the country or watching around the country, the singular voice that we see is we see Gavin Newsom, and we see in New York, we see Andrew Cuomo. We rarely, at least on the Cuomo press conferences, and I've given him good grades, he never lets the doctors talk. I mean, everybody is talking. He's the only one that's talking. And again, he's a great, great communicator. But in the case of the federal government, you not only have Dr. Birx, but you also have we're going to drop that off. Matthew, is that you or somebody else? Anyway, we have more than one voice. Let me go back to you, Kenton, because you obviously said that you don't think that Dr. Fauci at this moment. He's got too much power. Is that overstating what you said? I can't hear you right now. Go ahead.
We've walked into the cult of Fauci.
Okay.
That to me gets dangerous when one person who has one viewpoint of it, a health viewpoint, I get that. But that's got to be incorporated into greater models that say, what about the social? What about infrastructures that we're damaging? What about the economy that pays for all this health care? Are we going to devastate all those just as, you know, Daniel Henninger wrote a good piece yesterday calling the Dr. Strangelove virus. Now, again, if you ignore my tweets, you'll see that 3 or 4 weeks ago, I said we're going to approach a Buck Turgeson moment. Where, if you recall from Strangelove, he said, here are your two options. Neither of them are glamorous. You got X million killed or you got Y million killed. You choose. The virus doesn't care about interest rates. It doesn't care about Andrew Cuomo. It doesn't care about Trump or Fauci.
Right.
It's going to do what it does. We may get to a point where we have to make the ugly decision of, do we keep an economy and thus a nation intact and have X thousands dead, or do we continue down this path, ruin the economy, which results in greater deaths in the future? That's a tough call.
Well, it's also, we're talking about, obviously, an election year. Regardless, Trump thinks about things for re-election, but so do the Democrats.
I think this transcends elections. I really do.
Politicians, nothing transcends.
Roberto?
But I'll tell you this.
Let me go to Roberto first, and then back to Charles. Go ahead, Roberto.
Well, on the election point, I want to highlight leadership and give credit where credit is due. On St. Patty's Day, on the 17th, Illinois had an election. Ohio did not. Now, Governor Mike DeWine, a Republican, has been a great leader on this.
Yes, he has.
And you know, his state is ranked 27th out of 50 right now. And that's for a reason. He's doing all the right things here. Mm-hmm. Now, partisanship is kind of like passé, I think, hopefully. We're going to have an election in November. Part of the quote-unquote pork that we kept hearing about was where Democrats kept saying, we ought to allow more people to vote by mail. Now, if we allow people to vote by mail, some people predict that that might not go well for one party or the other. But allowing them to proceed in November is critical. Now, thank goodness, thank science, thank whatever you want to thank, Fauci or Trump, it seems that we have now hit less than 600 new cases in New York as of yesterday, which is just a 36-point drop. And I hate to say points, but it seems to have plateaued in New York. It was horrible. It was the epicenter. But things are working. This is, like I said earlier, it came to pass.
Things are working, but again, everyone has said that we're going to be able to define that better in a couple of weeks. Everyone thinks that mid-April, all hell is going to break loose. I mean, with literally a vast, you know, number of deaths around the country. But again, you know, by the way, next week or sometime in the next couple of weeks, we'll do a whole segment on the issue of how people should be voting. But you're right. I mean, some governors made early decisions. And again, as you say, Ohio is 27th. Another issue that broke in Ohio, but it was not the exclusive state and it's a federal matter, is the ticking time bomb that now has been revealed in prisons, county right. prisons, state prisons, and even in federal prisons where people
and aircraft died. Carriers.
And aircraft carriers. And that's another whole issue. Is we didn't get into that, but obviously that's another big issue that everybody could respond. Let me get just a quick answer. In your opinion, did the Secretary of Army, did he make the right decision in firing the commander of that ship? Yes or no? Kenton?
Yes.
He did. Roberta, what do you think? Did he make the right decision or not by firing the commander?
I'll side with all of his sailors that gave him a standing ovation, applause, and the answer is no.
So you go with the employees. Charles,
he already
Gibson,
came
we
up.
Go
he
to
already
you.
Tested positive, by the way.
We always go back to you. Go ahead. Charles Lipson, final word to you. Was that the right decision or wrong decision?
I think it was the right decision. He went outside the chain of command and leaked and made it possible to leak the information.
On that note, we want to thank Roberto Montano, Quentin McCarthy, and Charles Lipson. I'm Bruce Dumont. Thanks to Andrew Marshall. We'll see you next week. Until then, Bruce Dumont, good night from Evanston, Illinois.